Hey everyone, this is Frosty again. This is part two of our Q&A audio download from April 4th, featuring Sir Ridley Scott, William Monahan, and Mr. Beeks discussing Kingdom of Heaven, the director's cut. Hope you enjoy it.
Okay, well, let's turn on to the audience here. If we have any questions, raise your hand. I will. All right, we got back there in the jacket.
Nobody quite packs the frame like you do, Sir Ridley. Can you tell me, how do you approach the battle sequences themselves? You had them in Gladiator, and you turned around and refined it even further. I noticed your use of slow motion, your use of changes of depth of focus to underscore the emotion of the moment. Can you talk a little about that, please?
Yeah, I think it comes through experience, honestly, because I can tell you what to do and go out tomorrow and do this and that. And I think it really comes through just a lot of experience. And I know that doesn't help, but you know, but 2,000 commercials before I did a movie is actually a pretty good school. So I never went to film school. My film school was commercial. So I kind of learned every trick in the book and then paid for it on every movie I did on the complaints of critics that it was either too pretty, too gauzy, too beautiful, da-da-da-da-da-da. And eventually I realized, well, actually, this is an advantage. I'm dealing with pictures. So I started to relax and ignore it. But the battle scenes, I find that you like the film. By the time you get to your first day of principal photography, you've talked through the film so many times with the most important person, who's the writer. Then that evolution then steps up to the next important characters in the whole process, which will be production designer, costume designer, stunt coordinators. In other words, all the people in the field that will actually be supplying things on that moment, at that time, at that minute. And that just becomes constant polishing and discussion. And out of it, you get ideas and you exchange of ideas, and then you've got to coordinate that to say, yes, we can get it within the given time. But it finally comes out of experience.
Another question? Right there, in the black.
Basically, I have two questions. One for the director, one for the writer. During the battle scene at the end, when they broke through the walls, it became sort of confusing and a little bit misty, and you couldn't tell who was a Saracen or who was a Christian. And I wasn't sure if that was a directorial choice that was done on purpose during the battle to sort of mix up the identities. The second part of the question is, if you could elaborate on Valiant's surrendered at the end after claiming that Jerusalem was not the stones but the people. Why did he surrender at the beginning before giving up all that life? That's what it was about.
You want to go first and then?
Well spotted. The whole point was that they became one big morass of humanity tearing each other apart. That's where I get that pull out. That's where you get the maggot shot. Who's a fisherman in here? Anyone is a fisherman? Come on, put your hands up. Don't be shy. No one will admit they're fishermen. Well, if you take a tin of fly for fly off something and you take the lid off and it's a fresh tin of maggots, they're all in there, they're all waving at you like that, millions of them. And I was staring at this tin of maggots thinking, holy God, that's how we should pull out. And there'll be all these people tearing each other apart. That's how that came about.
Get this one. Do you think you could repeat that? Because I've got something I want to say about the siege, and I want to see how closely it corresponds to what's being asked. Yes, please.
It felt like at the end when he surrendered to the Saracens, previous to him surrendering, he claimed that Jerusalem was the people and not the stone of the city. But yet, he sacrificed all his lives and then just surrendered.
Well, you have to understand, at the time, if you made a defense of a city, you had basically condemned everybody to death. You know, if your enemy was to have to go to the trouble and expense and blood and money and everything else to attack you, when the walls were finally breached, you know, the city would be sacked and everybody in it killed. And that's essentially what happened in when the Crusaders under Godfrey of Bouillon took Jerusalem the first time, 1099. You know, a defense was made, and, you know, the city was finally taken, and everybody in it was killed, and that was more or less the rules of the time. You know, you'll hear it said that that's some sort of special brand of barbarity that, you know, was special to the Crusaders, which is a lot of nonsense. Simple rules of warfare at the time.
And he had no choice anyway at that moment, that the bad work had already been done by Guy de Lusignan, who was actually a historical character, who was probably only just part of the undermining of what happened, so that finally he gave Salah ad-Din no choice but to come. The taking of a caravan with Salah ad-Din's sister on it is also historically accurate. So I wonder if that was chosen, well chosen, by Renald or not. Was it deliberate or not? I'm sure it was absolutely deliberate. He figured out which caravan she would be on. With that, Salah ad-Din was constantly being pressured to, when was he going to deal with Jerusalem? When were they going to take it back? And I think Salah ad-Din, who had, you can correct me here, Bill, but within the Muslim history and context, Jerusalem was a small pimple on the Muslim backside. At this point, they had far greater problems further east. Isn't that true? So, and so Salah ad-Din was maintaining status quo in Jerusalem, didn't want that kind of problem, didn't probably want the expenditure of lives or attention. So in that instance, he was a good leader and politician. There's a moment he has to go. He's got no choice, didn't want to. Same thing happens when you have them coming at each other with such ferocity. The exchange between Salah ad-Din and Balian is after a short space of time. This siege was short. It was only like 10 days. A siege could go on from 2 to 5 years, where they would finally starve them out, water them out, or disease them out by, say, catapulting plagued animals or plague victims into the city. So they would go to that extent of actually, that's your first biological warfare. None of this is imagined. This is all in history books. In this instance, I think Salah ad-Din figured, wrong time of the year, he's going to be in trouble. And he's not actually getting through until he breaches one wall, but he still knows if he continues and goes inside, as Balian says, you're going to lose a major part of your army and you will never reform it. And so there was a negotiation.
Up there.
I don't know. I was thinking that perhaps with some of the, you know, some of the more delicate thematic material, right? I think was taken out of the theatrical cut that you see back in now. And when you're looking at the theatrical cut with that film, with that stuff missing, you know, you seem to be entitled to think, you know, is it a political film? And if it is a political film, what kind? You know, and I don't really think it is. You know, I mean, at this point, I'm just entitled to my opinion like anybody else, you know? But I really don't think it is. It's people expect it to be about 9/11. They expect it to be about Muslim-Christian relations. They expect it to be about this, that, and the other thing. And sometimes they get enraged when it isn't, or they fantasize that it is, or the film makes them say whatever they've been longing to scream about the subject anyway, irrespective of any provocation the film may or may not give. You know, so I don't think it's political. You know, you can welcome all that sort of thing, but I think it's pretty personal to me, and I know it's personal to Ridley, too. So,
Bill. ahead. Over there.
I was just wondering if you could comment on how Edward Norton got involved in this film and why he chose not to be credited, if I remember correctly.
Is Ed here? Come on, Ed, where are you? No, he actually said, I've read this script, I'd really like to do it. And that's how it happens. I said, okay, great. How much, you know? And then he says, what would be probably interesting is that there's no credit. It wouldn't it be fun to just do it? Which I think is one of the best ways of actually going about doing a job. That was as simple as that.
What about assembling all these other wonderful actors? You, in you know, a lot of supporting roles, Liam Neeson, Jeremy Irons, Brendan Gleeson, David Thewlis. These are people who you know we're accustomed to seeing in much larger roles. They you know, what was it that brought them to the film?
Everybody likes to get in spurs and you know look tough shit. You know, with the big sword and the horse and all that stuff. Don't put that out to one side. That's certainly the real reason. Jeremy used to love swaggering around with his cigars and all his gear. You know, he loved the gear. I think you should mention Martin Chokas, who played a really interesting bad guy with great humor. I think he was very amusing and also extremely effective. And I think Eva Green is really a wonderful actress, actually, plays Sibylla.
Yeah, I know Martin was having quite a bit of fun with his enunciation. Did you ever have to pull him back, or you just kind of let him rip?
No, he's like, you know, everything's a negotiation when I'm doing my job. I mean, the actor speaks, and I go, God, where'd that come from? So, I mean, are there any actors here? Come on, put your bloody hands up. You're all, like, look at them. There's one, I don't believe there's one actor in here. Okay. No, it's a negotiation on the on the day. Half the time, I don't meet these people till they walk on the set of the gear on. I'm going, who are you? Oh, how do you do? Okay, mate, this is what we're going to do. That's what it's like on a film of that scale. There's no wonderful sitting around for 6 weeks in a rehearsal room. That doesn't happen.
How long do you rehearse for a film like this?
About 2 hours.
Just that.
No, so what I do is the real rehearsal happened in a very nice little church hall in Hampstead, actually, in London, where I got with the key players, the love story, Balian, Eva, David. And really, it's whoever's at hand who can come in and be coordinated into a timetable. If they're not there or they're working, I don't get to talk to them except on the telephone. Or if they're coming in for a costume fitting, which, of course, they have to do, I may get lucky and get them for an hour or for a dinner. Then the next time I'm going to meet you in a forest in Spain, we're going to tear each other's heart out. That's how it is. That's what happens.
And William, what about you? You know, working with Ridley when you were pounding out the draft, did you ever find there were certain things that you might put in the script that Ridley wouldn't like, that you got used to him just not doing certain things, maybe?
No, nothing. I mean, it's not as if there's a run of stuff or a classification of stuff that he wouldn't like apart from stuff that doesn't work. You know, I don't think there's any further way to classify it. But, you know, I think, you know, a lot of the stuff is on the same page. A lot of things that come out for practical reasons, you know. You can't do a giant battle here because then you'll take away from your climax, you know, and things like that. So
yeah, we were going to have a huge battle at
Kerak. Yeah, Kerak and the Horns of Hattin.
Yeah, Bill wrote this huge battle at Kerak, and we couldn't afford it.
Okay, we couldn't afford to do the battle at Kerak. And not only that, I persuaded Bill and myself, I didn't really believe it, but the Battle of Kerak would upstage the Battle of Jerusalem. Would I have liked to have done the Battle of Kerak? Absolutely. But you can't. And I think Bill is being very modest about his capabilities as a writer, because if you ever get a chance to read a script of his, they are prosaic. And And so from my point of view, I hate to cut out anything because I think, oh, that's terrific. I somehow want to get it. I want to somehow encompass it, and I'd like to have it in the editing room. Unfortunately, it's just not practical for the budget, so you have to make tough decisions early on.
Well, being prosaic is probably just because you're also a novelist. You also write a lot of prose. How do you work between... Well, you have written a lot of prose, and I'm sure there's a few in the drawer.
Yeah, prose and worse.
How do you move between those two worlds, and how do you, maybe talk about...
Well, I don't move between those worlds now. I moved into this one, and I'm staying. So that's about it.
Any other questions? All right.
You mentioned earlier balancing the business aspect of directing and the creative aspect, and we're seeing a lot, it seems two different versions of the film, which were both amazingly different in feeling that they evoke. And we've already seen some of your films, seeing what's been cut out, things like Alien and Blade Runner and Legend. Have you wanted to, now that it seems to be more easy to go back and retouch those films the way that you originally wanted them to be, have you wanted to go back and touch on some of the films?
No, not really. I was watching an interview of a great old movie star, and Fred Astaire, actually. And the interviewer asked him what was his favorite movie. He said he didn't know. I said, why not? He says, because I've never seen him. So I think once you've done the movie and you've finished it and you've delivered it, it's as if that's one of your children. You're going to not put it in the drawer, but you hope it's going to do well. But to say what's your favorite movie, I can't tell you. I think it's so wrung dry once you've finished a movie, particularly this, any movie actually. I guess it's like writing a book. Once you've finished the book, would you ever reread it? Probably not, right? I think the great thing about digital DVD is it forces one, me, and I don't think I'm particularly any more engaged in DVDs than any other director, but I feel it's part of the business, it's part of what's expected. I quite like to do it, actually. So now you're almost obligated to complete revisiting where you normally never have revisited in the days of just doing a straight movie with no tape. Then we moved to tape, and so you have to then pay attention, look at the tape and see how it's graded. Now, digital, and God knows where it's going next with all its menus and God knows what else. There's the business side, it's revenue.
Any other questions?
I was just curious. The question applies to both brothers. What role models might you have had that when you're getting started, that might have inspired you through either a film that might have inspired you or a writer?
Well, Ridley inspired me. Tripoli, I was writing it as a screenplay, and I knew enough of the industry to know that it'd be very hard to get it made. And if it was made, it wouldn't be made right. This is long before anything. So I turned around and I started to write it as a novel. And so I was rewriting Tripoli as a novel, and I got kind of frustrated because I knew it should be a movie, and I just gave up, got a coffee, went in the other room, flipped on the TV, and The Duelist was on, which I hadn't seen since it was in the theaters, and then I thought, yeah, that's how you do it, So I went back, chucked the pages of the novel away, and redid it as a screenplay. And about 7 years later, lightning struck. And, we ended up talking at a breakfast table. During a meeting at which I was so nervous, I managed to get my corn muffin into my hair. because there I am, and the guy across the table appears in every respect to be Ridley Scott. And he's not only said he wants to direct Tripoli, he asked me if I know anything about Knights, you know, for another film. So, yeah, my answer is Ridley. All right.
That's very sweet, Bill. You never said that before. Right. The guy I go back to is Michael Powell, and I'd have to say there's four: Michael Powell, Kurosawa, David Lean, and Carol Reed. Oh, Orson Welles. Always kept looking at them thinking, why are these guys different? At a time when cinema was completely different, because my fodder on cinema, because of where I was born and where I lived, was whatever came out the Odeon cinema. So my fare was, you know, Hollywood. And I was in love with every Western I saw. So it was John Wayne, John Wayne, John Wayne, Glenn Ford, John Wayne. It was only when I went to London quite late that I got alternative cinema at the National Film Theatre. I used to live there, live in the theatre 5 nights a week, actually. That was informative.
Any other questions?
Can you describe anything that Orlando brought to the process that was different from other actors that you worked with?
Orlando did pretty good, didn't he? Yeah. He brings what you see from Orlando is what you get. And Orlando's a very honest guy, and he's very, very straight and very open, very committed. You could almost say there's an innocence attached to Orlando, which he still hasn't lost. And if he retains that, it's going to be really good for him. It's always very nice for him. He's an incredibly hard worker because he knew how, you know, big and challenging the process was and would be. And just his commitment, absolute commitment. I haven't quite come across that. I'm trying to think, since who? I better say Russell Crowe.
We don't really know if he was here. So, well, I guess... just to let you guys get out of here, but I'm kind of curious as to what you have going next. I've heard about American Gangster, and I know of The Departed. Could you kind of talk about those two films?
All right. Well, The Departed, which is a non-historical thing I did, is in post-production right now, and I guess it's going to come out on November 3rd of this year. So far as I know, and that's my birthday, so they'll be all right.
Oh, I've got to finish my film. My film comes out November the 4th. So I don't know whether they shift it or not. I'll have to find out. and I've done a film with Russell Crowe with Albert Finney, Freddie Highmore, and a lot of really great other actors. It's a comedy in Provence and works pretty good. But I'm working again with Russell and Denzel Washington on something called American Gangster, which we start filming in August and start moving around New York next week. It's a story of Frank Lucas, the guy who described him as Superfly. That's not accurate. But it's that period, it's the 70s, and it's about a man who became the king of drug trafficking in New York by shipping heroin through the army from Vietnam on army transportation. Who knew that? Did you know that? A lot of people know that.
Great. Well.
Yeah, you want to hear what I'm doing next? Bill and I are working again, actually.
Yeah, talk about it, please.
Go on.
There's this great book by David Ignatius called Penetration, which I'm going to adapt for Ridley. It's a modern spy thing.
You guys must be exhausted. Go and have dinner.
Thanks so much for...
And thank you, William and Ridley, for coming out tonight. We really appreciate it. It's a great film. Thank you.